she would be assassinated. We all knew it. I began writing her eulogy several years ago. This is not a woman who was to die of old age. She was absolutely assassinated, and I would like to point out that the single witness to the crime, Gustavo Castro from Chiapas, Mexico, continues to be held by the government. I just spoke to his wife a few moments ago, and they have not yet released him. They say for questioning now, more than 24 hours later. So this is a tremendous concern that this man be allowed to leave and to go back home safely to Mexico.
You mentioned the coup. Sylvia, we just have 20 seconds. But at the time, Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State and was very involved in what was happening in Honduras.
I don't know what she was involved in. She was involved in, you know, Lanny Davis was also involved in getting payments from the Honduran government, and he's very closely allied to Hillary Clinton. This is why this was never clear cut. It was never called a outright push to say for them to say it was a coup, and they backed off of that, and they didn't know what to do. It was a very confusing situation for them, but I think it's pretty clear now, in hindsight, what they should have done.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Sylvia Carrillo, the nephew and Beverly Bell, the close friend of Berta Caceres. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Fade to Black, a book release event for political prisoner Jalil Muntakam on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. This political education and community event will promote the recent book release of Escaping the Prison, Fade to Black. Jalil is a political prisoner who organized with the Black Panther Party in the Bay Area and was underground with the Black Liberation Army. He was captured when he was 19 in 1971 and has been locked up ever since. This event will feature local talent and activists including Black Butterfly, Kent Ford, Walida Imarisha, and many more. Again, that's Fade to Black, a book release event for political prisoner Jalil Muntakam on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th in Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven in Portland. Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, is a brand new variety show style monthly night, taking cues from vaudevillian traditions and narrative comedy. Each month's showcase features a different lineup of performers, bringing together a wide range of artistic disciplines and focusing on polished short pieces from our thriving clown, circus, vaudevillian, and alternative performance communities right here in Portland. Again, that's Oddville, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, 1464 Southeast 2nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, out-of-state developers are set to earn a huge profit in Portland's plan to develop the Pearl District.
A new study suggests half the world's population could be nearsighted by 2050.
And a ballot initiative to preserve endangered animals around the world is launching in Oregon.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 4th, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Portland officials have agreed to pay nearly $35 million for a large chunk of land near the airport as part of the city's plan to develop the main post office area in the Pearl District. The payment is double the value of the land. Before Portland can develop the dozen city blocks in the Pearl District, the city must first relocate the main post office currently operating there. The city's plan is to move the post office 5 miles to an area near the airport on land that has once been part of the former Colwood National Golf Course. The estimated value of that land is $17 to $20 million. The city has agreed to pay the land's owner, Trammell Crow, a Texas-based development company, $34.7 million, according to the Oregonian. Trammell Crow bought the industrial site in 2014 for just $6 million. City leaders could save taxpayers millions by condemning the property and paying fair market value. However, officials say condemnation is politically impractical and have instead agreed to pay a massive premium to secure the 47-acre parcel of undeveloped industrial land. As part of the move, Portland will pay the U.S. Postal Service $88 million for the Pearl District campus. The Pearl development is poised to become Portland's most expensive urban renewal project in city history.
Southeast Portland is seeing some major real estate investments these days. A 63-unit apartment building on Southeast 10th Avenue was sold last week to the Berkshire Group for $18.5 million. Another East Coast investment firm, ASB Real Estate, also bought a set of renovated office buildings on Southeast Water Avenue. Along with another acquisition on Northwest Flanders Street, that adds up to a total investment of $33 million just yesterday. The housing properties went up for lease last July and were almost full by the time Berkshire purchased the development in late February. A 510-square-foot unit currently costs over $1,500 per month. The investment company based out of Boston also announced that it could be closing a deal on a property in the same neighborhood as the Lower Burnside Lofts. The company currently manages 600 housing units in the Portland metro area.
Rallies are planned in over 35 states tomorrow in memory of Robert Lavoy Finnegan, the armed occupier of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, who was killed by state police in January. Hundreds have RSVP'd to events being organized over social media to what they are calling Lavoy Finnegan Stand for Freedom Rally. Most are being held at state capitals, federal buildings, or courthouses. Finnegan was one of dozens of men and women who occupied the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon, for 41 days. The FBI and Oregon State Police stopped Finnegan on January 26 as he and other occupiers drove to the community meeting outside the refuge. Finnegan was shot by Oregon State Police troopers after he fled from the traffic stop in his pickup, hit a snowbank, got out, and made reaching motions towards his waist, where he did have a loaded pistol. Goals for the rallies include collecting signatures, urging authorities to investigate how Finnegan died, and protesting the arrests of 25 refuge occupiers. At least three rallies are planned for Oregon, one in Portland, Salem, and Bend. Meanwhile, the leader of the occupation, Amon Bundy, is being held in the Multnomah County Jail in Portland. He has said he does not feel responsible for Finnegan's death or for the arrest of his 25 co-defendants, who also face federal indictment. The Department of Justice has also recently begun issuing indictments stemming from a similar 2014 armed standoff at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada.
House Bill 4040 may be headed for passage despite a controversy over whether it's necessary. If passed, the bill would reaffirm that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife followed the law in pulling wolves off the endangered species list last year. Environmental advocates say it's an attempt to derail a lawsuit against the agency alleging that they did not follow proper procedure in making the move. The bill was hotly debated last month, but yesterday passed the state Senate on rural and urban lines, with half a dozen Democrats voting to support delisting, along with all the Republicans. Oregon Wild is calling on Governor Kate Brown to veto the bill. According to a federal count in 2015, there are an estimated 110 wolves in Oregon.
A new ballot initiative to preserve endangered animals around the world is launching in Oregon. The campaign is linked to successful ones in California and Washington State. Scott Beckstead of Save Endangered Animals Oregon says the goal is to take the profit out of poaching.
So these are the 12 types of animals that are the most imperiled by the global poaching crisis. It includes elephants, rhinos, several species of big cats, marine species like the sea turtle, sharks, rays, and whales, and then a little creature known as the pangolin, also called the scaly anteater. The pangolin is covered with a thick armor of scales that provides a great defense against animals like lions and hyenas, but of course very little defense against high-powered rifles and snares and traps. The pangolin is the world's most heavily trafficked mammal species and will absolutely go extinct within our lifetime if we don't do something fast. So those are the types of animals that we have identified as being the most in need, and it's the trafficking in their parts that is addressed by this measure. I think it's important for people to understand sort of the broader context. So last year, the voters of Washington passed a similar ballot measure by a 70-30 margin. It passed overwhelmingly in all 39 counties of Washington. And then also last year, the California Assembly passed a ban on the trafficking of ivory. So if we can get this done in Oregon, we will have created a West Coast firewall against the smugglers who are trying to bring their products into the United States through our international ports. So the voters of Washington have done their part. The Legislative Assembly of California has done its part. And now it's time for the people of Oregon to do their part.
Tell me, how does this work? What exactly are you asking?
So this measure does not ban the mere possession of these items. So what we're trying to do is eliminate the commercial market for these products. So you can still legally possess these items. You can gift them, you can hand them down to your heirs and beneficiaries through your will or your trust, and you can donate these items. What you cannot do is sell these items in the commercial marketplace, and because essentially that the demand created by that marketplace is what is driving these species to extinction and driving the global poaching crisis. So again, the measure does include exemptions to avoid any unintended consequences. You can still pass down grandma's ivory brooch or granddad's ivory-handled revolver. What you cannot do is sell it.
All right. How do people get involved in your campaign?
Thank you. It's a great question. We're looking for people to help us in our signature gathering drive and to volunteer for the campaign. The best way to volunteer is to go to www.saveanimalsoregon.com. You can learn more about the issue there, and there's a link that you can go to volunteer. That's the best way. You can also go to our Facebook page, Save Endangered Animals Oregon, and there's also lots of information on our Facebook page about how to get involved.
Scott Beckstead, Save Endangered Animals Oregon. Thanks for talking with us today.
Workers began removing liquid waste and nuclear sludge from the Hanford nuclear site in eastern Washington yesterday, just one day before the deadline. Washington's Department of Ecology and Washington River Protection Solutions will have 1 year to complete the task of removing waste from a tank leaking material between its inner and outer shell. The tank currently contains over 800,000 gallons of hazardous material, divided between two different substances of liquid waste and nuclear sludge. The liquid won't be as difficult to remove as the sludge, which requires cooling to avoid generating hydrogen gas as the substance radioactively decays. The substance will then be transferred to another tank until it can be stabilized and properly disposed of through a process known as vitrification.
Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts rejected a request to stay the mercury and air toxic standards rule adopted by the EPA in 2013, which tightens restrictions on a class of harmful pollutants that are byproducts of... Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts rejected a request to stay the Mercury and Air Toxic Standards Rule adopted by the EPA in 2013. It tightens restrictions on a class of harmful pollutants that are byproducts of burning coal. This decision means the rule will remain in effect while the legal process plays itself out as to whether or not the Environmental Protection Agency weighed costs and benefits properly when they contested regulation was drafted. Petitioners in the case include more than 20 states, predominantly states with economic interests in coal-burning power plants. The EPA contends coal and oil-fired power plants are the largest industrial sources of air pollution in the country. Power plants are responsible for 50% of the mercury emissions in the United States and are particularly dangerous to unborn children. Environmental groups praised Roberts' decision, describing the ruling as a win for public health.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Portland's weather tonight, a 100% chance of rain with a low of 49. Rain continues throughout the weekend with a high of 59 Saturday and a low of 45 Saturday night. Today in history, in 1789, the Constitution of the United States officially went into effect. The first session of the U.S. Congress was held in New York City as the U.S. Constitution took effect. Of the 22 senators and 59 representatives called to represent the 11 states who had ratified the document, only 9 senators and 13 representatives showed up to begin negotiations for its amendment. The quote of the day is from Benjamin Franklin. "The Constitution only gives people the right to pursue happiness. You have to catch it yourself."
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Why are we Americans stuck with an out-of-date railroad system, while nations with a small fraction of our resources are cruising on high-speed rail networks? Because our leaders sold us out to corporate hucksters who destroyed our once great passenger train system by telling us that we Americans deserve the independence that comes from a glorious new doctrine of one person, one car. Yeah, the independence of being stuck in traffic jams. As early as the 1930s, giant corporate consortiums formed to buy out more than 100 of America's networks of streetcars and interurban train systems. Not to run them, but to rip out the tracks and pave over the rail right-of-ways to make roads. The biggest of these consortiums combined the enormous political and PR power of General Motors, Standard Oil, Firestone, and Mack Trucks. Likewise, corporate profiteers mounted a new offensive in the 1990s to undermine the higher speed potential of Amtrak's Acela trains, funding such coke-headed front groups as Cato Institute and Heritage Foundation to push hokey analyses branding Amtrak as a slow train to collectivist hell. They also bought trainloads of politicians who are still promoting the fabricated studies and talking points of the petro cabal to wreck as much of Amtrak as they can and derail fast train proposals. Railroad executives themselves preferring the oligopolistic and very profitable freight business to passenger travel play along. This is Jim Hightower saying, there's no economic, technological, geographic, budgetary, or conceptual barrier to our country having the best, most effective, state-of-the-art train service in the world. The reality is, the U.S. is in the caboose of transportation innovation only because special interest politics continues to thwart our national will, leaving us with a rail system that's a national embarrassment.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
A pair of veteran journalists in Wisconsin plan to visit eight cities around their state with an open government traveling tour later this month as a way to celebrate Sunshine Week. That's the national initiative to promote a dialogue about the importance of open government and freedom of information. Participants include a wide swath of advocacy organizations interested in the public's right to know. KABU reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Mark Pitch, who designed the Wisconsin presentation, about the need for governmental transportation, or rather governmental transparency, and what inspired his choices to make this transition from attendee to participant.
We are going to be offering 90-minute tutorials and discussions about the Wisconsin Open Records Law in an effort to get average citizens to learn more about the law, including how they can use it in their own lives. We have, as local sponsors, local newspapers, and also participating in the traveling show will be advocacy organizations on both the left and the right who agree on one thing, and that is the importance of open government to a representative democracy.
Is there a lot of variation in the accessibility of public records from state to state?
Every state has its own records law. I can't give you chapter and verse for 50 different states, but certain states make it much more easy for the public to obtain documents that government officials use to help shape policy. Other states make it more difficult. I would say Wisconsin is somewhere in the middle. It has a records law that presumes that all documents are open to the public, yet it also gives the possessor of the records ample opportunity to deny those records from being made public. In other words, if you're requesting records from, say, the State Department of Natural Resources, they have the opportunity to say, we're going to withhold these records for reasons X, Y, and Z, and the withholding of those records is more important than the public's right to know.
And how do you counter that argument?
Well, one thing is by education and vigilance, which is why we're organizing the Open Government Traveling Show. Frankly, the other way to do it is to hire a lawyer and to take government to court. If you feel like you have a strong case, the courts are a terrific avenue to try and make sure public officials and government agencies are held accountable for disclosing records that should be made public. Of course, hiring a lawyer costs money. So it's challenging for average citizens to be able to do that. Media companies like the one I work for have a little bit more resources to do that kind of thing. But still, we have to be smart about how we use our money. We generally don't take state or local government agencies to court unless we think we have a rock-solid case.
Can you talk about the primary components of this presentation and what principles guided its design?
Last summer, the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, which is the committee in Wisconsin that does the first writing of the budget, introduced a last-minute motion that would effectively have gutted the Wisconsin Open Records Law. There was an immediate backlash from the media, from open government groups, from liberal advocacy groups, from conservative advocacy groups, and frankly, from the general public in opposition to these moves. They tried to sneak it past. It was introduced at 6 o'clock on July 2nd, the day before a three-day holiday weekend. But the outcry was so strong that the proposal was beaten back. That was really the impetus for the Open Government Traveling Show. Not only did those of us who are sort of paying attention to how government works on a regular daily basis, but everyday residents of the state rose up against this, and we thought we needed to maintain the momentum and continue to offer this kind of education and advocacy on behalf of open government that the Open Government Traveling Show could provide.
Are all these cities in proximity to Madison, or are they a little more dispersed around the state?
They're dispersed around the state. They're all within about 2 hours of each other, so it's going to be a bit of a grind. 90-minute presentation in City X, and then a two-hour drive to the next one, and another presentation. So we'll see how it goes.
And that begins March 15th?
That's right, March 15th through March 17th for Sunshine Week.
For folks listening to our conversation wanting to get more information, is there a website you can refer them to?
You can get more information at www.spjmadison.com.
I've been talking with Mark Pitch. He is the president of the Madison, Wisconsin chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
That was Robin Ryan. And Sunshine Week begins March 13th. The KBOO Evening News celebrates it by sharing with our listeners our favorite internet tools for holding the elected accountable.
A new study in the Journal of American Academy of Ophthalmology says half the world's population could be nearsighted by 2050. The rise goes beyond just genetics, and it suggests it could be because people spend too much time looking at smartphones and computers. Demi Hellenius of KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Mom might have been right when she said you shouldn't sit so close to the screen, because it'll damage your eyes. Half the world's population will be nearsighted by 2050, up from a quarter of the population in 2000. According to a new study in the Journal of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, while Jay Knights, researcher in the ophthalmology department at the University of Washington, says genetics play the biggest part in determining a person's vision, that alone doesn't explain such a large shift.
The amount of televisions, computers, tablets, smartphones, all those kinds of things have increased dramatically. And, you know, if you're inside studying all the time and playing computer games, that is the largest correlate.
Researchers aren't sure why screens affect eyesight, Knights adds. It's only clear that modernized countries have been working closer to screens, and at the same time, nearsightedness has increased. A National Institutes of Health studies found nearsightedness increased in the U.S. by 66% between the 1970s and 2000s. A similar trend has been going on in East Asia, where researchers say as many as 90% of school children are nearsighted. Knight says that wasn't the case for an indigenous people he visited in Argentina, who live outdoors nearly their entire lives.
They measured the frequency of nearsightedness in those people, and it's virtually zero.
Researchers suggest children spend more time outside to help prevent developing nearsightedness. Oregon's plentiful forests could hold the key for some people looking to reverse the nearsightedness trend in their children. Ron Nichols works with the Oregon Department of Forestry.
We certainly encourage people to get out and enjoy Oregon's outdoors, because I think for people who've lived here a long time, it tends to be something you overlook, you know, and Oregon is beautiful. There are so many varieties of landscapes out there.
For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
Now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A Brazilian federal prosecutor Thursday opened a criminal investigation into alleged crimes committed by McDonald's. The federal prosecutor is looking into allegations of fiscal and economic crimes by McDonald's, including suspected tax evasion and violations of Brazil's franchise and competition laws. The Brazilian prosecutor, Marcos José Gomes Correa, has issued an indictment against McDonald's. If found guilty as charged, McDonald's could face serious penalties, fines and penalties of more than $342 million. Plus an additional 10% to 50% of the amount of the fine against the company to its CEO. There are also other penalties if McDonald's is found guilty. The UAW is protesting worker rights violations and hazardous working conditions at Ford Auto Parts supplier Ground Effects. The union says the Dearborn Auto Parts plant is interfering with a fair union election process at the plant. John Salazar was fired from the plant. He told the Detroit Free Press why the workers are protesting at Ground Effects.
The main reason we're out here is to get fair working conditions, better pay, safer environment. We have isocyanates that are used, chemicals in the company, without proper ventilation, and a lot of people have had problems with their skin rashes.
10 OSHA complaints were recently filed complaining of repeated skin contact with the isocyanates and the health issues that workers say it's caused. The UAW is trying to organize Ground Effects, and in July, the UAW lost by a single vote. The NLRB set aside those election results due to the company threatening to move or close the plant if it went union. Salazar says workers at Ground Effects need a union contract.
We need a contract with the company. Everybody that runs a business or does business has contract with their company. We think we deserve our contract with this company to be treated fairly and for our job security.
California Nurses Association, National Nurses United, says the union has reached a real breakthrough with tentative labor contracts for 8,000 nurses. The nurses work at Sutter Hospitals in California, in San Francisco and the East Bay. The tentative deals cover nurses at facilities in Berkeley, Oakland, and San Francisco. They will vote on the tentative contract next week.
Brought to you by Union Active, affordable, state-of-the-art web design using responsive web technology with easy-to-use content tools, member management features, and a host of other tools that make Union Active your perfect web solution. Designs, prices, and features are online at unionactive.com. Workers' Independent News is heard daily on The Rick Smith Show, live 3 to 6 p.m. coast to coast at thericksmithshow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Student protesters at the University of Honduras faced riot police yesterday evening while protesting the murder of human rights and environmental activist Berta Cáceres. Cáceres is known for her work protecting indigenous people in Honduras and fighting against environmentally threatening projects like the Agua Zarca Dam project. Early Thursday morning, gunmen entered her home and shot Cáceres four times before fleeing the scene. Police are still investigating possible suspects, though family members believe the killers were tied to the Agua Zarca Dam Cáceres had fought against. For years, Cáceres has received death threats for her activism. According to Global Witness, over 100 environmental activists have been killed in Honduras since 2002. Last year, Cáceres received the Goldman Environmental Prize, which honors committed environmentalists working at a local level around the world. At her acceptance speech last year, Cáceres said, quote, "Giving our lives in various ways for the protection of rivers is giving our lives for the well-being of humanity and of this planet," end quote.